jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news. I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. As we go marching on, we are called the Yankee soldiers who've enlisted for the war.
Welcome to Heal DC. This is Joni, and you're just listening to Sweet Honey in the Rock, Sojourner's Battle Hymn. I can think of no better song than to welcome and celebrate our guest for this morning, none other than our own Chuck Hicks. We are honoring Chuck on his 80th birthday week, sharing the challenges and the victories that he and his family faced in Bogalusa, Louisiana, particularly in the 50s and 60s, and then moving through Chuck's life in Syracuse, New York, and of course here in Washington, D.C. We're going to be moving quickly to cover these 80 years. Chuck was 80 years old last Tuesday, February 25th. He was born February 25th, 1945. So we're going to cover a lot of these decades of Chuck. Before we welcome Chuck, I also want to quickly give some other happy birthday greetings. Saturday was our own Reverend Graylin Hagler's birthday. We give a big cheer for Reverend Hagler and everything he's done to fight for a better world. It was also Harry Belafonte's birthday. My dear friend, James Sherrod, had a birthday on Tuesday, same day as Chuck. James is his son. Some of you may have heard the stories about his son who was killed by D.C. police 2 years ago last summer. We send our love and support to James and his family. And just quickly, this coming week, we have Marion Barry's birthday on March 6th on Wednesday, and we have our own Nkinji Touré. His birthday is March 5th, and of course, Nkinji was the one who helped launch. Every year we celebrate International Women's Working Women's Day for a whole day, and we will be doing that on Saturday. So happy birthday to Nkinji. Okay, now we're going to jump in the rest of the hour. We're going to be speaking with Chuck and going quickly through his life. Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Joni.
Glad to have you with us. We're going to be going in, of course, certain categories. We're going to start with an overview of Chuck's early life, then move into, we'll just take it one step at a time, but we'll be moving quickly here. Let's start, Chuck, with your early childhood in Bogalusa, Louisiana, particularly in the 50s and 60s. What was it like for you? And I'm saying early childhood up to the time when you were getting ready to go to college. What was it like growing up in Bogalusa?
It was rather interesting, Johnny, because Bogalusa was a city, and it was they had a factory there. So most of the areas surrounding Bogalusa were farming areas. But we were a city. We did not farm. We had paper mill and a box factory. So blacks in that town were somewhat independent. We had our own schools. We had our grocery stores, shops, restaurant owned churches. We were somewhat independent, and we did not have to go out of Bogalusa for anything we needed. One of the first things that I kind of, and we had theaters, movie theaters. We sat upstairs, white sat downstairs, and sometimes they threw stuff at us and we threw stuff at them. But one of my first recollections of racism came right when I was about my junior year, about going into my junior year, senior year of high school. My parents had decided that since I was going to college, they were going to start buying me clothes for college. And I remember we went into this men's store and we picked out some suits and some shirts and a whole bunch of stuff. And then my dad went to put it on layaway. And I remember the clerk said, "Now, boy, I want you to make sure you pay this bill on time." Next thing I knew, my father said, "I'm not your damn boy, and I don't have to pay anything on time. I can go to the damn bank and get the money out now and pay for it." So my mother said, no, let's just go. And so that was the first instance of racism that I came face to face with in Bogalusa. Like I say, we were separated. We went downtown. We couldn't eat downtown, but we were in a situation where downtown was, we were right next door to downtown, so we had cafes and places to get to eat, and we had our own schools, and we were one of the best schools in the parish, so that was kind of it until that point. I never really thought much about race.
Even though you had heard your mom had told you about Emmett Till, of course, that was an experience.
That was an experience, and I remember my mother was standing at the front door, and maybe somebody had called her. She was talking, and she was crying. And I wanted to know why was she crying, because I hadn't seen my mother cry. I couldn't remember. I just cried. And she said, "Well, they're killing black boys. Even black boys, young black boys are safe. It's just horrible."
And, of course, you were a child yourself then.
Yeah, I was 15, 16.
Yes. And real quick, tell us what your dad worked in one of those box factories.
My dad worked in the box factory. There were two units, box factory, plant, and a paper mill. And that was an industrial part of Bogalusa. My dad was also the president. There were four unions, one at the box factory, one at the paper mill. It was a black union and a white union at both of them. My dad was the president of the black union at the paper, at the box factory. And they had all the men in the factory joined the union. I guess some of them did. So I'm not sure what they did, but I guess they kind of had grievances and sort of. The thing I do remember at some point was that they filed a suit because there were no black supervisors in court. And my dad became the first black supervisor in the city.
Wow. And I hate to do this, but we're going to keep rushing through and jumping to the next situation, which is when you went to college at Southern University and you were expelled.
What happened was that I had been very active on campus, like I was in high school. I was in the journal club in high school. I was on the newspaper staff. I was in student government. So when I went to Southern, I was very active. I was on the class council. I was in the theater club. I was on my dormitory board for your dorm. We had a little president and board, and I was on that. And I was popular, active, well-known on campus. And one night, the dean of men called me and some other, about four or five other people into his office around 5:30, 6 o'clock. That was the first year they had Peace Corps volunteers on campus. And it was a mixed group, and they stayed at the edge of the campus. So anyway, he said that they were concerned that our group used to meet, some of them, and they ate in the dining room, and out, and we sat and ate with them. And then we would sit on the quad and talk for a while, and then they go to their dorms and we go to ours. So that evening, the dean of men called us in and said that they were just concerned that wouldn't be any problem because they didn't want anything to happen, because this is the first time down south that they had an integrated situation. And so we assured him that we only ate with them and that was it. So as we got ready to leave, he said, "Mr. Hicks, I need you to stay. I got to talk to you about something." So I thought it was something about student government, because the people I was with were not necessarily active. He said, "We're concerned that you're causing trouble with these people. You become a troublemaker." And I laughed and said, "Right, Dean Jones, a troublemaker." He talked for a few minutes. He said, "I have no choice, but I have to expel you." I thought it was a joke. It must have taken him 5-10 minutes to convince me that he was going to expel me. And he showed me the papers. I was just devastated. The only thing he said I could do for you, and now that I recollect this, I'm sure he fought to do this. He was a decent person. He said, "I can let you withdraw. If you withdraw, Mr. Hicks, then you can go any place else in the country and go to school, and your record won't follow you. But if we suspend you, and they want to know where you went to school or whatever, they're tracking it, and we expel you. And when your record shows you expelled, it makes it difficult for you to get into school." And then, so I called my parents, and I was absolutely devastated. I said, "I've been kicked out of school, and I didn't do anything." And then my parents were aware. My dad had been leading a boycott in Bogalusa to get them to hire blacks in the downtown stores, to hire people in City Hall, to hire policemen and firemen and all that kind of thing. And so what they had done was they had organized caravans, and they took people out of Bogalusa to Covington, to Slidell, even to New Orleans to shop. And this had been going on for about 6 months or so. So it was killing the city, because Bogalusa was probably 35% black, and the rest white. And not only that, Bogalusa was the town that the city where the surrounding towns and little counties came to shop at. And since blacks came there to shop too, when we were shopping there, they didn't go.
So your dad was leading that boycott
it was an effective boycott. So they called the governor in, and the governor, they said, "You need to do something. It's killing the town. We're broke." And so the governor at some point threw my dad, along with the group that was forming this, was called the DC Voters League, which my dad was the vice president of. So these were four of them down, and the governor asked them to take off the boycott. My dad said, "Well, I'll take the boycott off, and you can give us some clerks and J.C. Penney's and these Woolworths, and you give us some black policemen, some people in City Hall." It's all the things that the man, he said, "I can't do that." He said, "Well, I can't call the boycott off." So what happened was, when they flying back, the governor had a press conference and said that the Bogalusa Voters League had agreed to a cooling off period for 6 months. My dad said when they got back to Bogalusa, they went to the union hall. There was probably a couple hundred people there. He said, "Them Negroes was mad as hell with us because they thought we had sold out." And the press was saying, he said, "Not only did we not sell out, but we are going to march on the Capitol." And there's an article called "The Longest March in Civil Rights Movement." Bogalusa to Baton Rouge, 126 miles. No other march was longer than that during the Civil Rights.
Wow.
And so that is sort of the essence of that. So when I got
And did you go on that march, Chuck?
No. I was it took them about 2 weeks because they had to have potty trains, they had to have places to stop, the parks and area where there were black churches that would hold, let them stay there and all of that. So what happened was I was so devastated. I didn't know what to do. And I think if I thought of suicide, it would have crossed my mind. I wouldn't have done it, but I would have thought that that might have been an option. I was the first person in my family to go into college. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school in the South, the Army would come in and all the black boys in the South, they had to take the Army test. I didn't take the test, and the sergeant wanted to know why I wasn't taking the test. I said, because I'm going to college. I don't need to go. So he went and got the principal. He said, this boy don't want to take the test. Mr. Crump asked me, why wasn't I taking it? I said, because I'm going to college. And so he said, well, I can't make him take the test. He's going to college. And so all that was weighing on me. So I called my parents and I said, look, I'm being kicked out of college. And the other thing was that the dean of men told me I had 2 hours to get everything I own out of my dorm and leave in 2 hours. I asked the state troopers to come, take everything I had and put it on the side of the highway. I called my parents and said, they're kicking me out of school. I didn't do anything. I guess I was just tow up. And they said, don't worry, we're coming in Baton Rouge to Bogalusa, was probably 2.5 hours. They got there in about an hour and 45 minutes. My dad was driving 90 miles an hour. And I didn't know what had happened, but the dean of men, the governor was striking at me because of what my dad had done. The horrible thing was that when I got out, everybody knew something had happened. And while we were very active in Bogalusa, everybody didn't like the Hicks family. There were people who didn't like us. Like, there were a lot of people who respected us, but didn't like us. And the thing was, I got kicked out right before Easter. So I was home 2 weeks before kids came home from college. If I had been kicked out and could have came home during that time, I'd have been like, I just came in and decided not to go back. But everybody in Bogalusa knew in a day or two that the Hicks kid was no more in school, and why? Wondering why. So yes, one interesting thing, my parents said that, well, he's got to go to school. I remember hearing this conversation. They said, yeah, but he can't go in the South because any place that we sent him, the governor would track him, and they couldn't afford to send me to a private school. They tried to get rid of my sister, but she was a dealer, and Dillard was private, so they couldn't do anything to her. I had relatives in Newark, New Jersey, and New York. And so they called my relatives and they said, Charles has been kicked out of school. He needs to come up there to go to school. And they said, send him up. So I ended up going to New York staying in Jamaica, Queens.
Yeah, that's right. That's my home territory. And so you were in, I'm sorry to try to speed this up a little bit to get you into when you go to Syracuse, but you stayed there in New York for a while, and then you wound up in Syracuse. So just tell us about that.
CORE, and CORE was involved in a program where they were taking from the very smart kids, mainly in the East and from the Midwest, Chicago and the East and stuff, and offering them scholarships. They all would have gone to school, but they probably would have gone to state schools. And every school that took a student had to promise him a 4-year ride. They called the people from CORE, told my parents about it, and they called me and said, well, there's a man you need to call. They got this program. So I made the call, and the guy said, I'm so sorry, but the program is closed. But they had heard, they knew of Bogalusa because Bogalusa was all over the news nationally, regularly, with marches and protests. He said, wait a minute. So then he started asking me questions and talking to me. So I knew he was interviewing me. So I was interviewed without him knowing that he knew that I knew that I was. So he said, let me see what I can do. So in about 3 days, he called me back and said, congratulations, you're in the program.
Wow.
I had to go. In about a week and a half, I had to go to Brandeis for summer school there, for orientation. So I went to Bradenton for school, so you but we haven't been able to find anybody. Tell us where you'd like to go to school. I have no idea in the world. I said, I don't know, someplace like Syracuse. He said, you're lucky, the guy who knows his best friends with the chancellor. They've been boyhood friends. If anybody can make this happen, he can make it.
So wow.
2 days later, he called and said, congratulations, you're in Syracuse.
Wow, amazing. So this was 1964, the summer of 1964. And a lot was going on. So we're going to kind of see if we can speed up the story a little bit. So you later became, well, tell us about the when you spoke with in New York City with Fannie Lou Hamer. Was that before you, while you were at Syracuse or before?
Yeah, it was while I was while I was at Syracuse. What happened was that my dad was, along with Fannie Lou Hamer, where they were going on a speaking tour to raise money for some of the cities in the South, the groups. Mm-hmm. Like every group in a small town had their own civil rights group. While CORE came in, SNCC came into the Mississippi, you had a group in there that was based, that ran the organization. So of course in Bogalusa, my dad was the Voters League. But what had happened was they had a massive arrest, and they had arrested maybe 30 some protesters. So they had to raise money and to get bail to get those people out. So he couldn't leave to go to New York. I think he later joined the tour. And he said, well, I got a son in New York, he can speak. And so I think it was at Hunter College.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got there and Ms. Hamer was sitting there and I greeted her and she said, how you doing, baby? I said, I'm fine. I said, you got your speech ready, Ms. Hamer? She said, oh, honey, I don't need a speech. I can tell them what's going on. So first of all, they had some programs and some speakers, and then they called me from Bogalusa, where the Deacons were founded. I started, I had my little speech, couple of papers, and I got confused, and my papers got out of order, and I was stumbling. She said, boy, put them papers down and tell them what they're doing to your folks in Bogalusa. I put the papers down, and I was on a roll. And from then on, I can speak whenever I need to speak. And that's how I met Fannie Lou Hamer and was friends with her for as long as she lived.
Wow, what a story. Well, people actually are calling me on my phone. We have somebody from Ask Me calling, but I'm not, we'll get up to Ask Me in a little bit, but we may be able to take one or two callers. Barry Carey, if you're listening, you can call in a little later. But let's keep moving. We're talking with Chuck Hicks, our own Chuck Hicks, and his life story from Bogalusa to Washington, D.C. So going back to Syracuse, you became the first Black person elected to be student president.
Yeah, well, actually, as a Jew, I was very active in Syracuse because I was on my dorm floor. I was involved in some community groups outside of Syracuse, but also I was on the student council. I was on the class council. I was doing all that. So as a junior, I was a group of people. I was on the student union board. So as a junior, some people asked me to run against this lady because she was usually a senior's head of the student union board. And I ran and won as a junior. So I was the first junior and Black that would be head of the student union, even though we didn't have a union. Mm-hmm. We used a dormitory that we used, the basement for activities. And so I ran that and we reprogrammed and we did a lot more things. We had a jazz band on Friday nights and we had on Saturdays we had a dance. in the basement of this dormitory. We did a lot of different things. We played cards during the week, all that.
Okay, Chuck, I'm gonna just try to make sure we get in a few of the other amazing stories. So this was 1960.
I ran for student body president, the night of my last night with my team, we were doing our final rehearsal, and this guy came over to my campaign manager and whispered something to him, and then he called my vice president over, and then they called the rest of my my slate over. Then they all came over and said, "Chuck, we don't know how to tell you to tell you, Dr. King has just been assassinated."
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I was actually devastated. So I said, I won't campaign until after his services. And so somebody said, "But you could lose." I said, "Well, I'll lose, but I won't go out and campaign before that." And so my team said, my state said, "Well, we're not campaigning either." So when the guys and the state heard that I was not going to campaign against them, because it was like a two-week campaign, they said they wouldn't campaign. So we postponed the elections until after our King services. And we had a big service, memorial service in the chapel and all of that. So after I won, the night after I won in my victory party, I went to Chicago. I headed to Chicago for the Democratic National
Committee. Wait. I'm going to stop you here because I wanted to go back to 65 with what happened with your dad, unless you want to.
Well,
you want to go back to 65 or you want to.
You want to talk about when the deacons were.
Yeah. So I'm trying to do it in the time frame. We're going to pause for a minute. Then we're going to go back to the Democratic Convention in 68. But meanwhile, as you were getting ready to, you are perhaps already in Syracuse. February 21st, 1965 was the day 50 years ago last week when Malcolm X was assassinated. And on that day, it so happened that the Deacons of Defense from Greensboro were on their way to Bogalusa.
And then also the Montgomery boycott was going on.
Okay, the bus boycott.
They came in, and Bogalusa was actually the first chapter of the Deacons. Outside of the Deacons were formed in Greensboro, Louisiana, by two veteran guys who had been in the war. And so they were having problems, some of the same problems that Bogalusa was having. And they were against the police support, and police were going through neighborhoods, and the white Klan and stuff were going through neighborhoods and shooting, and the police wouldn't respond and do anything. So they formed a group called the Deacons. And the reason they used the word the Deacons, because it was like a code, a cover, because when you think of deacons, you think of church, people in the church, at least black people do. You say, "Oh, Deacon this, or Deacon Hicks, or Deacon Brown, or Deacon Eisenberg." And so you always knew that they were talking about somebody in the church. So when they formed this group called the Deacon, lots of people, particularly white people, thought initially that there was some group of people from churches coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the code thing for the deacons. And the deacons came in and swore in the deacons. And then they set up the organization. They had walkie-talkies. They had people who started to guard neighborhoods. One of the things that the deacons did was they assigned people to watch certain neighborhoods in the black community, particularly at night. The shifts usually ran from 12 to 6 or 12 to 5. There'd be two or three people in every neighborhood sat on their porch and watched. If somebody came through, they knew that it wasn't a black car or what they could see, and they got on the phone and say, "We got it. We got somebody coming through," and they stop them, or they and so want to know where they were going, or they when they came through, they were there, and whenever they shot at somebody, they fired back.
And then you say 12 to 5, was that in the nighttime or daytime?
Yeah, say midnight.
Midnight. And they
probably around 10 o'clock. I'm not sure of the time.
Okay, so, but Chuck, I remember you telling me that at one point the Klan was marching into your family's.
What happened was that in the South, when they were trying to integrate restaurants and stores and things like that, they had what you call action, a day of action. And so they practiced like the like when they were, and those people set up the lunch counter where they had been, they had gone through some training. So everybody was trained if you were gonna go to the Five and Dime store, if you were gonna go to Abby's Cafe, you were trained what would happen. So they all went in and the city had said that there was going to be a test run, so nothing was going to happen. But when those black kids got into those stores, they had trouble. They threw water on them. They tried to burn them with cigarettes. They just went ate wild on them, but they held their ground. So after that, it was supposed to be a one-day test. And then everything was supposed to be over. But since this was basically a lot of young people, they said, no, we're going back tomorrow. We're not giving up. And so at some point, in Boca Rosa, when CORE came in, they had three people.
Chuck, let me just let people know you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. This is To Heal DC with Joni, and we're spending the hour talking about Chuck Hicks and his activist amazing life.
So anyway, when they CORE sent in people, our family was the only family who agreed to take in the three CORE workers who were all white. So after that, when the march was over and they came back,
if somebody can mute their phone that's ringing. I don't know if that's you, Chuck, but
I think it'll go off.
Okay.
The police came down at some point during the evening, early evening, and he said, I came to escort these civil rights workers out of town because I got a mob of 150 white men headed coming down to lynch and burn your house down. And lynch
you
all.
You say 150 white men were coming to burn your house?
Yeah, they were forming, they were gathering to come down. And so my dad said, well, you're the police. Your job is to protect you, protect us. And he said, that's what the law says. He said, I can't protect y'all. Only thing I can do is get them out of town and then they won't come. And my mother was the first one to respond. She said, no. I later asked her why she said no. She said, because I'm a mother. I couldn't imagine any mother doing that to my son. And so at some point, my dad said, you can't protect us? He said, no, I can't. And so my dad said, I'll get my own protection. So my dad told my sister Barbara, and the deacons had other deacons were, they had a phone line, they had a list of people they could call whenever anything was happening. So my sister got on the phone and called some people and said, quick, bring your guns, the mob is coming to lynch us and burn the house down. Tell your wives to call other people. So, in a matter of, I guess, 45 minutes, there must have been 75 black people at our house. And they were not only were at our house, they were on our roof, they were in trees, and they were in people's porches and in trees. So I guess when the chief of police and the police saw all these people coming, they told him, you better not go down there because they're armed and they're waiting for you. So what happened, and so the three white workers were able to get a call out to AP in New Orleans before they eventually turned all the phones off in the black community. So
they turned the phones off?
In all the black community.
Who turned the phones off?
The telephone people, the company, EMP.
Wow.
And so they were able to get the word out to New Orleans to AP and other news people. So around 6 o'clock in the morning, the press came down and they saw all these black men in trees, on porches and everything. And they asked my dad, who are these? And my dad said, this is the Deacons for Defense and Justice. And that hit the wire, and it went all over from New York Times, LA Times, Chicago, wherever. And so one of the reasons when people hear the Deacons, they think Bogalusa, because that got the notoriety. But we always say is the Deacons started in Greensboro, and we were the first chapter. But that's how that issue of the Deacons got started, and how those people didn't come down. But one of the interesting things was, my dad turned to my mother, he said, well, what are we gonna do? He said, we're not leaving. He said, neither am I, I just wanna get my children out. So they took the first people, first car that came, my dad and my mother put my brothers and sisters in a car, laid them down, and drove across our backyard to a corner, over the next corner, and took them to a friend's house where they stayed for about 3 days. Mm. And their brother said that they were horrified. It's the worst thing in their life, because there was no news going on, and they couldn't use the phone, because if they had used the phone, they would have heard, and maybe they would have sent somebody down to kill them. And so we went for 3 days, not knowing if my parents were alive or dead or anything. To hear them tell that story is just heart-wrenching.
So that problem was resolved in, how long did it take for the family to kind of get back to any kind of?
Well, I think we never. We by that time, and certainly after that, didn't have a normal life. When we were growing up, one of the things that we did every night, we sat down and had dinner together. Lots of families just got a plate and went, but every night, 5 days a week, we sat down, we had dinner, we talked. My mother said, what did you do today? Or my dad would say, you went fishing, did you catch any? We had a family conversation. And so we were in a 3-bedroom house that we owned. And so we had my parents' room, we had the boys' room and the girls' room. But after that, we didn't even sleep on the beds anymore. During the civil rights, we slept on floors. Besides, we had civil rights leaders stand with us, and sometimes they stayed in one of the rooms, and we all stayed in one bedroom and slept on the floor. Because the windows were, our beds were next to windows, and people shot in there, we could get hit. So we didn't sleep in beds. We stopped eating as a family together. Just everything became discombobulated for probably 18 years before we started to come back as a family.
Wow. Okay, Chuck, we have about 10 minutes left. So if you could real quickly just maybe share a few sentences about when the white youth from the north came down to Bogalusa, and briefly how your family and other families supported them.
Well, they came down, of course, to help with the voters' right, and they have set up freedom schools and stuff like that. And so they, once they got there, they were protected by the Deacons. They did all our legal work for us. They went on marches. When they went to a march, they were the first to attack. Before they attacked Black people, they were trying to get to the whites who were marching, because they felt they were the reason why Black people were doing this. Now beginning to realize that Black people had made these decisions to do this, and white people came with resources, who were lawyers, been in college, so they knew how to write a brief and do a lot of things. And then, of course, the Black people had to go to work during the day. Lots of Black people still had jobs.
I'm sorry, Chuck. I'm getting people texting me wanting to call in. let's just, because I want to give you at least a few minutes about in Syracuse and how you arrived in D.C. But is that okay? You want to jump into Syracuse, or you want?
Yeah. Well, like I say, as I became student body president, I went to Chicago for the Democratic Convention, and then I went to the Erica Huggins and Bobby Seale case, where the government invaded Vietnam. And while we were there, it was thousands of people that supported Bobby and Erica. And when they invaded Vietnam.
Well, okay, when you say Bobby and Erica, remember you have young people listening too.
Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins, who were part of the Black Panther Party. And there's a picture where the judge gags Bobby Seale. He's sitting in the chair with handcuffs and his mouth is gagged because he was constantly blurting out. So the judge decided that he would gag it. And so we were there. And so when that happened and they invaded Vietnam, half of the people there went back to their campus and started organizing against the Vietnam. And she supported Erica and Bobby. And that's where Kent State and Jackson State were where the two students precisely got killed during the Vietnam, protesting the Vietnam War. But after that, I went to Syracuse and I went to graduate school there. And one of the things about being in Syracuse after all of that, I had been arrested 30 times after I got to be student by the president. If I left the campus, the police got me and they would lock me up. I must have been arrested 30, 40 times and the university would come and get me out every time. And so at some point I was in graduate school there and I helped write a grant for the University of Maryland School of Library Science. And they got the grant at the last minute. So my professor, who was my mentor, said to me, he said, Charles Ray, you know, it's not, I know you're under a lot of pressure here. He said, why don't you, I was going to get a PhD in higher education administration with an emphasis on Black studies. He said, why don't you get a master's? We can arrange to get you, if you go to summer school, you could get a master's. Then you could go to school in Maryland and you wouldn't be under the pressure that you said, because the city's not going to let up on you. And I don't know how much longer you can stand to be harassed by the city. Of course, the university is going to protect you.
But wow.
When you move, they're going to get you.
So the professor advised you to leave Syracuse?
Yes.
And go to a safer place.
And I had a full ride to Syracuse, so they gave me a full ride to the University of Maryland.
So I
was there in College Park, and then I moved to D.C., and I got a job after working in Maryland's prison. I got a job at the Martin Luther King Library, and they had the Lorton program. And since I had been working in the prison, they were looking for somebody with experience. So they hired me to work in the Lorton program. We took a bookmobile to Lorton and to the youth center. And that's how I got into the D.C. Public Library.
Wow. And you were in the...
I got there, one of the first things they did, somebody came up to me, and I was, Jim, white guy, said, how would you like to join the union? I said, I'd love to. I said, my dad has always been a union man. I said, I believe in the union. My dad used to say, the best friend that a working person can have is the union.
Wow.
You can't have a better friend than
that. Yes. So, Chuck, we have a few more minutes. We're going to take one caller, and that's Dr. Greg Carr, who's holding online to share his words with you. But so then you joined the union, and you were with the D.C. Public Libraries for at least 35 years until 2010 when your dad passed and you retired. And, of course, you still do a lot with the libraries.
Well,
you worked in.
I joined the union, and then I became a shop steward. And then I became a president of the library. And then when I became president of the library, I went on the Council of 20 executive board. And the first thing I did.
Okay, so Chuck, keep in mind that many people don't know, you became the president of, tell people what asked me.
Public Library.
Okay.
And then all the unions, all the local unions form an executive board and they have committees. And then when I got on the executive board as president of the local, the first thing I did, they asked me to do was to chair the political action committee. And at that time, Council 20, anybody who got elected in this city for 20, 30 years came through the union. We elected Mary, Eleanor Holmes Norton. Eleanor Holmes Norton would tell you today that if it had not been for Council 20, when she was running for Fauntleroy City, Betty Ann Cain, she was losing. She called the union went out and organized Ward 7 and 8 and we, for every one vote, what's four and five, sure, or two and three turn out. We turn out two, and we put Eleanor Holmes in front row seat.
And Mary Berry. And Mary Berry. So that's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, yes. DC 20. It represents, it's the largest union in the whole region, representing the most people. And
I served as president of the council. I served for a while as the executive director. And we elected Marion Barry. One of the wonderful things that the union did under Marion Barry and Vince Gray was that they orientated every employee had to take a one-on-one course on AIDS, HIV/AIDS. Every employee go through that.
Marion
Barry order.
I worked directly with that, with the training of the workers. But let's I want to give Greg Carr a chance to say a few words for you, and then Chuck, you'll have your final words before we have to leave. Good morning, Dr. Carr.
Good morning, Joni. Good to hear your voice. And here's Baba Chuck. What's going on, man? Happy 80th.
Oh, Brother Carr, I am so elated to be talking to you. We missed each other, but we have a date. Remember that.
That's on me because
it certainly is.
Greg, I hope you heard this amazing story of Chuck's life and down there in Bogalusa, what his dad did, and they were fighting the Klan. 125 people basically were out to get them, and quite an amazing story.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny. I was in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago, and somebody told me they were from Bogalusa. I said, oh, so you know Chuck Hicks then. You certainly know the Deacons. we were singing a duet. You probably heard it from all the way from South Carolina. But I tell you, I know we don't have a lot of time here, but I just wanted to call in and, you know, thank the ancestors and creator and your parents for 80 times around the sun, and we're going to claim you for 80 more. And I tell you, whether it be, of course, you know, being Mr. Black History, a master teacher at that is enough on his own, but your work with the unions and, of course, coming out of those deep soils of Black resistance and self-determination and the civil rights and Black power movement, and, of course, coming out of that family is just remarkable. But I'll tell you this, every time I go to the Martin Luther King Library, and I go probably a couple of times a week, and yeah, Joni, I wish they would keep that green book exhibit down there. I'm going to say something to the Secretary of Smithsonian if I get to him. But I always go up to the fourth floor, and I tell you, I'll never not go to see you tell the stories of how you spread literacy throughout this region, including some of our most vulnerable people, because one of your greatest gifts to us has been the gift of empowering people to discover their love for reading. As a reader, I would say, you know, Baba Chuck, your ability to reach into people's imaginations and put books in their hands. A story, by the way, everybody can see. If you go to the fourth floor of that beautiful restored Martin Luther King Library, there's a video up there of Chuck Hicks telling that story of how he had people choose the books they love and fall in love with reading. Brother, that's a gift that we'll give after all of us, our ancestors. So, you know, we love you. We're grateful for you. Thanks, Johnny, for letting me say a few words.
Well, we're very thankful you can. And of course, Chuck, as you probably know, that Dr. Greg Carr is from the South himself in Tennessee. And so he definitely knows that from his spirit and his parents, some of the things you went through and can still feel them today. So,
stand on your shoulders.
And Greg, you just have any word for Chuck and for our other listeners about today? What are the lessons of that we have from Chuck's family? And Chuck can answer this as well, of course. From his family growing up with the Klan and everything they had to go through and where we are today. Any words?
I'd say this, and then I want to hear Chuck lead us out today. We've been through this before. And the things that y'all faced, I was at the D.C. Black History Film Festival on Friday night, and they showed a documentary on Vernon Dahmer. And it was amazing. The things that you all faced, Chuck, the things that your parents faced, and Joni, the things that your parents fought in the North and New York, show us that these people who we have to face down today, they are pale imitations of the ones we faced down before. And since we won before, our victory is certain. All we have to do is remember and act. And Chuck, your life shows us that, brother. We are not going down. We are going to win as a complete human family. So we thank you, brother.
Thank you so much, Dr. Carr. And Chuck, your words are your words, if you want to bring the spirit of your dad or mom or anybody else in.
I think two things. I think there's so many high points in my life. One of the high points was when I was able to speak at the Million Man March and help organize the unions to come to the Million Man March, particularly on the East and around the country, because the unions did not endorse officially the Million Man March. And one of the things that I said at the tent was that we are here. We are here to stay. And I say that today. We are here. We're here to stay. And as old folks used to say, and it comes out of the Bible, this too will pass. Stand strong. Don't give up. Face it, and you will see. This too will pass. We are here to stay.
And of course, Chuck, what you saw and you learned from your dad, and then you did it yourself, was we are here to stay. And part of that is through organizing. And your dad, again, did amazing organizing, as have you. So we need to have hope, and we need to keep on organizing the people.
Okay. I hope you'll invite me back, because I want to tell people how we have two or three artifacts in the African Museum of History and Culture.
Well, you can share. I won't do any announcements other than to say next Monday, this Saturday, I'm actually doing a special show for International Women's Day, Saturday at 10. But tell us about what artifacts from your family are in the...
We have my dad's shotgun that he had during the movement. And also, engaged glassy and shotgun. And under that shotgun is a little stool with a hat pin. And the reason what the hat pin is because two things happened in the movement. Men wore overalls, and they had that little slit in the side, and they carried razors. And if the police tried to search them, while they were marching, they just stuck their hand, slid it down, and dropped it on the ground and keep walking. They didn't have to dig into their pockets and bend their arms. But the women carried hat pins. When you went to church, and certain churches, you wore hats, you had a hat pin in it. Women carried hat pins, so when them white men tried to jump on them, they stick them with the hat pin. That's the reason they have the hat pin on that stool under my dad's shotgun.
Wow, what a story. So people can go to the museum and find that. I don't know know what floor it's on, or probably great.
They moved it. It was on the third floor. I'm not sure if it's still there. But they'll tell you. You just say, I want to see the gun for the deacons, and they'll show it to you.
Okay, great. Okay, Chuck Hicks, we're very proud of you, and we're very proud that you shared your family story. I know you're the spirit of your mom and your dad is with you all the time. Just last, tell us about the house or the dedication to your father, Robert Hicks.
Yeah, we are building a museum, a family museum, not only for my dad, but all the people in the civil rights movement. And it is now in the National Historic Trail of Park and Recreation. It's on the state landmark and a couple other things. And it should be opening in about a year or so.
Wow. So we'll have to make a tour down there.
Yes.
Fabulous. That's going to be in Bogalusa. Is it named? The museum going to be named after your dad, Robert Hicks?
Yes, the Charlotte Robert Bob Hicks Museum.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, Chuck. Well, happy 80th birthday, and happy birthday again to Marion Barry's birthday is this week, Nkinji Touré, Harry Belafonte's birthday was Saturday, and as well as Reverend Hagler. You're in good company, and thank you to our engineer, Kalia, and we're going to go out with as you requested, this powerful song with Fannie Lou Hamer, sung by Fannie Lou Hamer.
March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack, all one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPF.